Now time for a catch up on stories making headlines across the world on this week's World Report with Justin McCarthy.
Good morning. On today's programme, the international community monitors tensions in Kosovo and the changing face of Iceland. But first we go to India, where hundreds are dead after a devastating crash involving three trains in the eastern state of Odisha. The crash is being described as India's worst rail disaster this century. A high-level committee has been established to investigate the accident, with many questions about the cause still unanswered. From India, Shalu Yadav reports.
A tragedy that will be mourned for a long time, as hundreds of precious lives were lost on the railway tracks of the state of Odisha. Just as it approached dinner time, passengers were thrown out of their wits as their lives completely overturned within seconds. A passenger train en route to the southern city of Chennai derailed and several of its coaches ended up on the opposite track. As if this was not tragic enough, within minutes a superfast express coming from the other side overturned the carriages and derailed as well. Another freight train believed to be stationary was also hit, leading to a mangled, twisted debris that kept scores of people trapped for hours after the tragedy struck. Rescue forces worked overnight and all day on Saturday to cut through the tough metal of the carriages and extract survivors. Visuals on television and social media showed the coaches and the twisted wreckage lying on the railway tracks, dead bodies being carried away from the spot, even as the scale of this tragedy is still panning out. A survivor told the media that he woke up from the thunderous sound when the train derailed and saw multiple people piled on one another. When he left his carriage, he saw someone had lost their hand, another person has lost their leg, and someone's face was disfigured. The cause of the accident is yet to be determined, and a probe has been ordered by the authorities to find out the exact cause that led to the moment of this tragedy. Prime Minister himself visited the site of the accident and expressed grief for the victims and their families. The authorities as well as the hospitals remain overwhelmed and the families are looking desperately for their loved ones as the rescue operation has been declared over. Locals are rushing in large numbers to the hospitals to donate blood for those in need. In fact, they had also been helping the rescue teams and provided them with supplies of food and water. India's railway network is one of the oldest and largest in the world, with millions of passengers using it every day. Its infrastructure has always been a work in progress, and accidents are very common, despite the government investing hundreds of millions of dollars to improve it. In fact, the latest accident is believed to be the worst India has seen in the last two decades. People here were reminded of the horrific train disaster in 1981 when an overcrowded passenger train was blown off the tracks and thrown into a river during a cyclone in Bihar state, killing at least 800 people. Such mishaps are mostly blamed on human error or outdated signalling equipment. Prime Minister Narendra Modi has been getting flak on social media for the negligence that often causes these tragedies. Some say that he has been promoting the development of high-speed trains at the expense of improving the older trains. People here are asking why the government is spending more on the new trains when the older passenger trains remain outdated and prone to disasters. Questions are being raised about the safety standards of the existing trains. There have also been calls for the resignation of Railway Minister Ashwini Vaishnav, as many say that he should take responsibility for this tragedy. Flanked by the media, he was seen at the accident site crawling from under a coach to take stock of the situation. This image hasn't gone down well, as many call this a photo op opportunism. But beyond the political blame game between the big names are the hapless faces who are too numb to ask any questions from the government. For World Report, this is Shalu Yadav.
Next, we go to Kosovo, where tensions have been running high after recently boycotted elections and violent protests outside municipal buildings. The instability is being closely watched by the international community, including the US, which is keen to avoid the escalation of a conflict in continental Europe. From Pristina, Owen O'Sullivan reports.
In the warm summer air of Mitrovica in Kosovo, people casually stroll across the bridge that joins north and south of the town, stopping to take photos of the view, chat casually on their phones and carry shopping home, simply navigating through the concrete blockade and armoured vehicles positioned at either side. From the outset, it may seem peculiar to have such security measures in a seemingly peaceful place. It is not until you reach the north side of the bridge, seeing from that point on, that the streets and shopfronts are emblazoned with Serbian flags, that it becomes clear something is amiss. Once a single united town, Mitrovica was separated in 2013 into two municipalities, north and south, in an attempt to ease tensions with the ethnic Serbs who remain in North Kosovo after Kosovo's declaration of independence from Serbia in 2008. Sirta, a young Kosovo-Albanian woman who works in a secondary school on the south side of Mitrovica, tells me that people live normal lives here. There has always been some provocations, but it has never been as bad as right now, she says. On Friday, the 26th of May, ethnic Serbs attempted to block the newly elected mayor of North Mitrovica from entering town hall. Protesters clashed with Kosovo police, clashes that were repeated in four North Kosovo towns and which saw protesters being tear gassed and cars being set alight. In April, snap elections were held in the region that were largely boycotted by the ethnic Serbian community, a community that does not recognize the Kosovan government and one that is backed by Belgrade. The result is a turnout of only 3.5% and the election of four Kosovo-Albanian mayors, mayors who demonstratively entered their new offices and raised Kosovo flags above town halls. In response to the clashes, the Serbian president, Aleksandar Vučić, stated on national television that he had put the army on a higher state of alert and ordered urgent movement of troops to the Serbian-Kosovo border, also demanding that K4, NATO's led peacekeepers in Kosovo, protect ethnic Serbs. While American Secretary of State Anthony Blinken stated that Kosovo police's actions had unnecessarily escalated tensions. Sieta agrees that things have happened quickly, telling me, yes, I want to see a united Kosovo, but maybe the new mayor should not have put up the flag immediately, starting more internally. Things may have been more peaceful. Then, events took a more violent turn on Monday, when 30 peacekeepers and more than 50 protesters were injured in further clashes, prompting NATO to deploy 700 additional troops to Kosovo. This rapid escalation has caught the attention of the international community, calling for an easing of tensions, with EU foreign policy chief Josep Borrell stating that he had asked both parties to urgently take measures to de-escalate tensions immediately and unconditionally. While the international community puts emphasis on both sides, Kosovo believes that it is Serbia who is stoking the flames of instability. Kosovo's president Vjosa Osmani tweeted, "Serb illegal structures turned into criminal gangs have attacked Kosovo police, K4 officers and journalists. Those who carry out Vucic's orders to destabilize the north of Kosovo must face justice." This is a sentiment shared by many Kosovo Albanians. This reporter spoke to Flamur, a Mitrovica local, who said, "There are many who protest peacefully and show their faces. It is the ones who wear masks. They might be getting paid by Serbia." And with Reuters reporting that the Z symbol had been spray-painted onto NATO vehicles during the protests, a symbol that is synonymous with the invasion of Ukraine, there are serious concerns for a deeper divide, even fracturing, of Kosovo in the future. But for now, it is clear that Europe and the international community as a whole cannot risk the possibility of another conflict on the continent, stressing for both sides to stand down and for status quo to remain. So much so that America, a longtime ally of Kosovo, has cooled relations, with its ambassador to Kosovo, Jeff Huvnir, stating, "We will cease all efforts to assist Kosovo in gaining recognition from states that have not recognized Kosovo, and in the process of integrating into international organizations if Kosovo does not back down." It may be the threat of alienation in the international community, a community that the independent state of Kosovo is struggling to be recognized in, that has led it to reconsider its position. With the Kosovo Prime Minister announcing on Thursday that he's prepared to hold new mayoral elections in the North Kosovo region. Although Kosovans are determined to have their state recognised, the memory of the war in 1998 and what is at risk is still vivid in many people's minds. As Sirta says, "We have been okay with everyone living here, but continue as Kosovo and not be divided, and with peace." For World Report, I'm Ono Sullivan in Kosovo.
Finally, we go to Iceland, and last Thursday, the US said it would stop sharing some information with Russia about its nuclear arms. But on Friday, it said that it wants to talk to Russia about future arms control agreements. This is the latest in a long line of disagreements and agreements over nuclear weapons between the two superpowers over the years. One of the most famous of those disagreements took place in Reykjavik almost 40 years ago. Ronan Kelly recalled it when he visited the Icelandic capital.
"I was reminded about Ronald Reagan while lying back in a hot springs pool. The geothermal pool, surrounded by volcanic rock, is in the Icelandic capital, Reykjavik. And this is where US President Ronald Reagan came to meet Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev for a summit to limit nuclear arms. That summit took place in 1986, and back then I was working in CNN in Atlanta and was fielding calls from viewers who were angry at the news channel's coverage of the Reykjavik summit. They would open with phrases like, "I'm from the Midwest, where we work for a living." Their basic complaint was that CNN was showing Gorbachev at the summit. Once or twice I'd wonder how they suggested we cover a meeting between two men and only show one of them, but usually I'd just listen patiently until they hung up and then scoff at them in my mind. The Reagan-Gorbachev summit in Reykjavik led to a treaty on nuclear arms and cast Reykjavik and Iceland as a place of the possible. And having been here for the last couple of days, I think Iceland could possibly be called the land of clouds with silver linings. For example, one of those clouds appeared in April 2010 when an Icelandic volcano erupted and the plume of ash caused international air travel to be disrupted. What was a short-term setback for air travellers was a long-term boost for Iceland. That's because at the time when the TV news shows showed the volcano spewing ash, the reports also showed Iceland's bleak beauty, and millions of people from around the world decided they'd like to come and visit the place. That's one reason why over 40% of Iceland's income comes from tourism. The population of the country is only about 300,000 people, but nearly three times that number visits every year. A couple of students I met told me that they thought Icelanders were less uptight than other Scandinavians. They said they think there's an attitude here that no matter how bad things are, it'll work out all right in the end. They even have a phrase for that belief, "Þetta reddast." It's the Icelandic equivalent of, "Don't worry, it'll be grand." The students were working as guides at an open-air museum I visited, which has a collection of traditional houses dismantled and transported to an old farm in the city. They include a house made from turf and stone. One of the students said her father was born in such a hut in 1951. The museum has a series of exhibitions in some of the houses, including one entitled "Oh, What a Lovely War," which told how, while the rest of the world was at war in the 1940s, Iceland was occupied by the British and the Americans to deny it to the Germans. The Americans stayed here during the Cold War and built a huge base outside Reykjavik, which is now the site of Iceland's international airport, Keflavik. The US base was the only place to have TV on the island until the mid-1960s. This fact was told to me by a grandmother I got chatting to about the changes in her life. We were in the audience at a concert in the enormous, new, dramatically shaped concert hall on Reykjavik's waterfront. This woman told me that when she was younger, she was a professional singer, but had to give recitals in a local cinema, and that she'd have loved to sing in the new venue. When I marvelled at the concert hall to another Icelandic woman, she screwed up her face. The building was started before the financial crash of 2008 and then stopped. As an unfinished project, it was a daily reminder of the crisis, but when the government stepped in to finish it with public funds that were sorely needed elsewhere, they were heavily criticised. Of course, in the eyes of the world, Iceland's response to the 2008 banking crisis was more laudable. The country jailed some of its top bankers for fraud. Since then, the Icelandic economy has bounced back and diversified. The country is rich and prices are high, although not dramatically higher than Ireland. But this new prosperity, with outsiders coming in to work in the tourist industry, has led to a housing crisis, according to the students I spoke to at the museum. For young people, they say, the rents are very high and there's a lack of new homes to buy. Familiar sentiments for Leo Varadkar, who was here for a Council of Europe meeting. While he was here, he took time out to tell the Icelandic Prime Minister that he wanted to see an end to Icelandic whaling, where the Icelandic government's own research has shown that some harpooned whales take hours to die. Our Taoiseach was probably pushing against an open door because the Icelandic Prime Minister herself is thought to be opposed to whaling. She's a socialist green, and Iceland, where the earth is at its most spectacular, is already seeing the effect of climate change, with more violent storms and shrinking glaciers. The Icelanders I heard from are gloomy about climate change, even though they still reach for their "it'll turn out grand" phrase, "Þetta reddast." And "Þetta reddast" does apply to that 1986 Reagan-Gorbachev summit. At first, it was a disaster. The two men couldn't agree and went home without signing a treaty. But the Reykjavik meeting meant that the groundwork was laid for a signing which took place in Washington the following year, Theta Redist. Although I thought of Reagan and Gorbachev the other day when I was looking at a news report in the local paper here about the Council of Europe meeting. One of the decisions at that meeting was the setting up of a register of damage suffered by Ukraine as a result of the Russian invasion by Gorbachev's successor, Vladimir Putin. I was caused to recall again the irate anti-communists ringing CNN in Atlanta complaining about us showing Gorbachev, and I wondered if I had scoffed at them just a bit too much. For World Report in Reykjavik, this is Ronan Kelly.
Well, that's it from World Report for today. The programme was edited by Elaine Devlin. If you want to listen back, you can go to rte.ie/World Report or wherever you get your podcasts. We're back again at the same time next week. Until then, for myself, Justin McCarthy, and all the team, thanks for listening and take care.